Welcome to the CLT Podcast, a series all about things related to learning and teaching in higher education, brought to you by the Centre for Learning and Teaching at Leeds Beckett University. In this episode, listen to Hannah Pocklad, Alan Smith and Professor Mike Seal as they talk about critical pedagogy and its involvement in higher education curriculum. Wherever you may be listening from, we hope you enjoy.
I'm Hannah Pocklad. I'm a student at Leeds Beckett University and I'm partway through my Masters in Youth and Community Work.
I'm Alan Smith. I'm Course Director for Youth and Community Work courses, but also an Associate for the Centre for Learning and Teaching.
I'm Mike Seal. I'm a Visiting Professor in Queer and Critical Pedagogy at Newman University, Birmingham, and a National Officer for the Professional Association of Lecturers in Youth and Community Work.
So, we're here today to discuss your book, Enabling Critical Pedagogy in Higher Education. This is an area I'm super interested in, and I've just read your book, and I do find it a very practical and compassionate guide to integrating that ideology and that way of thinking into education. And I haven't really seen it put in such a way before, in such a tangible format. So I guess I'd like to start by asking, what is critical pedagogy to both of you?
I'm handing to Mike for that one. You're the professor in it.
Yeah. What is it? I suppose, actually, in a funny way, I'd say it's not just a technique of teaching or anything. It's a whole philosophy of... what is knowledge? So it's like both epistemological and ontological, you know. So it's kind of who gets to create knowledge, how that knowledge is mediated, you know, and then how it's kind of then conveyed to people. And I think it tries to encompass all of that. And the basic thing is that there isn't some teacher at the front who's all knowledgeable and just slowly pours that knowledge into the student's head. It's that doesn't make any sense. You know, actually, because particularly with the student body, the people you've got there is hundreds of years of experience, if you just add it up. And actually, that's where the knowledge comes from. And in some ways, we're kind of just steer it and facilitate it. And probably more to the point, get people to believe that their knowledge has value. You know, because often you come to university and you've got to learn things. Not that I need to look at what I already know. Mm. So that's my starting point. But yeah, I think it goes right across the whole board. It's not just, it's a fancy way of teaching. It's something more fundamental.
For me, I suppose, we're all three sat here as youth and community workers. Mm. And our education, if we don't embrace it as an approach, as critical pedagogy, is disempowering, it's disingenuous. It's white, male-led. Mm-hmm. It's the pedagogue stood at the front telling you what you need to know. And that goes completely against everything that we have as a profession, which is about listening to people's opinions, giving voice to the voiceless, challenging oppression. And yet the nature of higher education can be that. It can be one white bloke sat at the front or stood at the front telling you what you need to know. And at the end of it, you sit in the exam and they tell you if you've passed it. And it's like, well, hang on, I'm not sure that's the type of education that is right for who we are and what we do. And I think critical pedagogy, to me, gave me a sort of a language that I didn't necessarily have to explain what I was frustrated about in terms of education. And when you're a student, I don't think you question it. I don't think you challenge it at first, particularly as an undergrad. You live in awe and fear of getting it wrong. And it's only towards the end of that you start to think, well, actually, I'm about to go out and manage a building or manage a staff team or do this. I'm 25, 20, whatever. And I have got a voice. I have got an opinion. I have got value. Why aren't you listening to it? And I think youth work educators were probably one of the first to push those boundaries and start to question and challenge it. So for me, it's that it's an umbrella for a range of different approaches and understandings. And that is also around decolonizing the curriculum and a whole set of other education is catching on to EDI issues, equality, diversity, inclusion issues. But I think critical pedagogy has it at its heart.
Mm. I was going to say, Hannah, because I mean, you've experienced it, if not just through Alan teaching you. Does it feel different being subject to it? So when you're in the kind of community work classrooms?
Certainly. I mean, I've never experienced such a level of autonomy and respect and receptiveness. That sense of empowerment through things like undefined roles, through informal education, through those barriers being removed and dismantled and discussed as well.
Right.
Which I think I'm very, very grateful. I mean, as a white woman, I'm aware of my privilege, but also my oppression and the intersections of that, and being in education, and most of the lecturers, most of the staff are white cis men. A lot of the material that we're taught, a lot of the things on the curriculum are ideologies rooted in neoliberalism, coming from, again, white cis European heterosexual men. And I think a lot of people are bored of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the same time, a lot of people haven't necessarily realised the structure of that either. But you spoke as well in the book about students not being used to having that autonomy.
Yeah.
And that freedom and what to do with that freedom. And for me, sometimes it can be a bit of an adjustment as well, because we're simply not used to it. That hierarchy is ingrained in us.
Yes. Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm going off at a tangent because I've upset the second years by asking them to negotiate with me a group assessment task. So I did it with you as an MA group, but for second years, to get them to mark each other and them to have the same equal power in that judgment as me has completely thrown them. And they're all almost uncomfortable with being given power. Mm. And it's like, well, it's 40% of a module mark. It's not going to decide whether someone qualifies or they don't. Just own it and live with it. And you can start to make informed judgment. And I know you've had similar, haven't you, when you've been trying to bring people through a process and get them to embrace it.
Well, I suppose most university education is you treat students as other and then you teach them about others. The fact... what you don't do is actually look at what's in the room and what's going on. And yeah, when I've done that and said, okay, well, we'll get you to mark your own work, they're like, what?
why are you doing that?
Because there's a security in those power relations in a funny way.
Well, I'm paying $9,500 a year. Yeah. I want you to mark my work.
Yeah, you should be, I'm paying it. You should do it and tell me what the right answers were. I mean, I was teaching, multi-agency working the other day, and it was quite a bunch of widening participation students. It was a really interesting mix, but they were looking at a case study, and I could just tell because I kept saying, what do you think of this? And I kept saying, why do you want to privilege what I think? Mm. You know, why is what I think? I said, well, you're the person who knows. And I was going, what gave you that delusion? You
know? Yeah.
And also I said, look, do you think that, because it was a case study, that I've got a kind of tick list of this is what they do, and if they do this, then it's right. Because I said, it's blank. You know, there is no right answer how to do this case study, and your opinion is as good as mine. It's about how you create that argument and articulate it. And I remember one just went, that sounds really good, but can you just tell us the answer? And he was just going, look, on a really fundamental level, no, I can't, because there aren't them. What makes this work or not is something we need to work through together. And but that can be terrifying for people if they've never had it, you know.
I know you tell that story about tearing up the...
Yes. And I suppose it's
the answer.
The answer. Well, it was more just I was teaching critical pedagogy, and what you tend to do at the beginning of a module is you spend time going through the learning outcomes, which often the lecturer doesn't really understand, and I'm sure that the student isn't listening. So it's one of those strange exercises that happens at the beginning of a module. And I was just reading through them, and I just went, Because the whole point of critical pedagogy is that you create the curriculum together, that the way it's taught comes from the people within the room, all of that stuff. And I was thinking, the idea of I'm going to read out some preset learning objectives about critical pedagogy. And I went, that doesn't make sense at all. But I went probably a bit too far, a bit too quick. Mm. And I just was quite dramatic and just said, right, well, I'm going to tear these up. And I literally tore them through in the bin. And I said, look, you come up with your own learning objectives, and what you do, I'll take to the module panel and change the module in those lights so you can do like those adjustments and stuff. And then I said, I'll come back in an hour and see where you are. I went and had a coffee and then came back in an hour. And they had literally got the piece of paper out of the bin and were trying to sellotape it back together so they could look at the learning objectives. And, you know, I think it takes time to work towards that place because, you know, freedom is scary sometimes. You know, I don't think people find it necessarily an easy space to start with. But once you get a taste for it, I think it can become something quite magical.
And I was going to say, I'm thinking about over the last few weeks with the MA group, we knew where we wanted to get to, but we've had to build the confidence in the room to have difficult conversations almost, haven't we? It is a process.
Yeah. Well, that's what I like about the book as well. I think it instills confidence in practitioners, in educators, and it highlights that it requires patience. It's not an easy process. It's not necessarily a comfortable process. You might have to say goodbye to a lot of comfort and a lot of privilege in this process as well.
Particularly academics.
Yeah.
Because they're used to it.
Yeah, certainly.
But it isn't comfortable, and it is that sort of growing into it, isn't it? That you have to. I also think that whilst it's almost a bit disingenuous that we say you have power, you have freedom, because we've got to recognise there are validation requirements, there are exam boards, there's a whole set of institutional bureaucratic things that we've got to work with. But in a sense, it is exactly like being a youth worker. Until you know the rules of the game, you can't push them. And that's what we create, I suppose, in those conversations where I'm saying to a group of students, I want you to mark each other.
Yeah.
It is pushing a boundary, but the external knows what I'm doing. She's seen it. She understands it. There's a recording of it. And I can hand a patch of them over and say, this is how it was marked. And this is, so I can tick the bureaucracy box, but honour the spirit of it in the room. Yeah. Mm. But that's taken several years of sort of negotiation with the externals. And Mike was our external many years ago, so Mike's seen it from that side. Yeah. But also, because I suppose we've got youth work externals, they're embedded in that philosophy and that approach. So it seems to work quite well, but you always have to be minded of this sort of external bureaucracy that I don't want to sell you short as a student because of my particular values. It's about you having a meaningful experience that is valued and sort of meets the requirements. And it is that how you design the course, how you plan it, the curriculum you put together and the way you teach it has to sort of have an integrity. Mm. And it takes time and discomfort because it's us giving up power.
Yeah.
And we're used to having power.
It's
an interesting
one. It's nice and comfortable to have power.
Yeah, it is, completely.
But I think that's it. People don't want to acknowledge that privilege and that platform.
Yeah.
But actually, if we acknowledge we have that platform, there's a lot we can do with it.
And I was going to say, the other thing is that I'm imagining, maybe less so with master's students, but I'm almost imagining students want to be taught. You've had that experience. Mm-hmm. Just tell me what I need to know.
Yeah.
Tell me how well I've done.
Yeah.
Tell me that I've passed.
Yeah.
So actually...
Well, it's some regulated, sensible tool that we're just used to using.
We're almost trained.
To measure intelligence or creativity, even.
But, like, I know your first degree was in photography.
Mm.
And that has to be subjective. It can't be.
Well, yeah, that's
else.
The irony, isn't it? Yeah. But I think, like I've said to you in the past, even on that course, which obviously was all about creativity, we weren't given that autonomy as students.
And
we weren't really given that
actually.
Freedom. Yeah, it's surprising, yeah. And as I said, I didn't expect this necessarily on a youth and community work course.
Yeah, it is strange, isn't it? That
But it makes sense because it encompasses the values entirely.
And I suppose that's my problem, is I make assumptions about creative degrees and I'm thinking, oh, God, the autonomy there, it must be fantastic. And actually, there's a real structure. You've got the modules still, you've got credit points, you've got all those expectations. But actually, they've not taken the step outside the box and said, let's do it differently. Let's take a risk. Let's try something. And I suppose we've found a method or an approach that allows us to step outside the box. And it's growing. There's a growing awareness of critical pedagogy.
Yeah.
And I think that's giving it a bit of a safety net. We've got a couple of professors now.
Yes.
We're using the language and it's in the title. So it's just starting to come together.
I'm just thinking of the kind of new lecturer. Because it's a funny thing, lecturing. Because, you know, they don't all get through this route, because in the youth and community it's quite different. But a lot of them, you know, you study for years and you do a PhD, which is normally you're studying one tiny thing, normally locked in a room, spending a year doing literature review and all this kind of stuff. And then eventually when you finish, they go, that's great. Now, see them 100 people over there. Go and lecture. How does that give you any skills to be able to do that? So I think, you know, that kind of thing of what a lecturer is, and I've known lecturers are absolutely petrified by doing that. You know, they're petrified by even doing the old, and what they end up resorting to is the only thing that seems to be proper, which is standing there with a lectern as a symbol of power and reading something out, which people write down, because there's a comfort in that. But they don't know any different. You know.
But there's a comfort for students as well as them, in both sides.
Yeah, both deluding themselves that it's meaningful, you know.
Well, it's a certain passivity about it, isn't it? And again, that's comfortable.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, the only room you're in a lecture theatre for is a research module that's taught by people who aren't youth and community workers.
Yeah.
Everything else we teach in a flat room where we're sat at a table just like you are.
Yeah.
So even the environment, all of that thinking that goes behind how we timetable and how we deliver is trying to mirror some of these values. And then ultimately, if you're going to get your master's, you're going to write a dissertation, we're going to have to teach you how to do research, lecture theatre, big rooms. And it's like almost, but it's so stark is the difference in how that is. And I've taught one of the sessions and people don't really necessarily engage with you in conversation. You are just delivering. And then at the end, a couple of people hover around to ask a question.
At the end,
But nothing happens in that 40 minutes, hour and a half. It's someone at the front, the pedagogue, delivering.
Yeah.
And it's a very,
and
very
you see
different
the impact on the students and I think on the lecturers as well. I think it's less engaging for everybody in that way.
Yeah.
And I suppose in modern days, what is the point? You know, why do you need, you know, lectures don't work at all. It's the worst, you know, because you can create podcasts, you can create an online lecture, and I think it's moving that way. But if you're going to do just that straight transfer of information, well, just say, read this. What do you need a lecture for? It comes back from the days when there weren't enough books to go around, so you had to talk it. That's where it comes from. And yet we still retain it as some idea of this is how you transfer or get people to discuss knowledge. And it just doesn't make any sense on any level. But it feels proper. Yeah. And I think some people, you know, like when you become a professor, you go and do an inaugural address, which is, again, standing at the front, doing this lecture, wearing a silly gown. Because then you're officially proper. You know, and it's just a bizarre set of rituals that we have. And I think that the lecture is a ritual which was outdated 50 years ago, let alone now. And yet it's still the mainstay of how people teach. You know, it's bizarre.
To listen to more in our podcast series, click on the subscribe button. And to keep up to date with the Centre for Learning and Teaching at Leeds Beckett University, follow us on Twitter @LeedsBeckettCLT. Thank you for tuning in.